Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There was a pretty extraordinary bail hearing today in Florida. George Zimmerman took the stand, and in a moment that drew a rebuke from the prosecutors, he apologized to the family of Trayvon Martin. They were in the courtroom.
I wanted to say I am sorry for the loss of your son. I did not know how old he was. I thought he was a little bit younger than I am, and I did not know if he was armed or not.
George Zimmerman is accused of killing the unarmed teenager in February in that gated community in Sanford, Florida. He's claiming self-defense under Florida's Stand Your Ground law. The judge ruled Zimmerman should be held on $150,000 bail. If the family makes that bail, there will be conditions. And there's still a question as to whether Zimmerman should be allowed to leave the state as he's requested for his own safety. Matthew Petty is with NPR member station WMFE in Sanford, Florida. Boy, Matthew, this went over 2 hours. The Zimmerman family also testified. They were on the phone line because they said they were afraid, as we said, Trayvon Martin's family in the courtroom. Did it feel like a trial?
Yeah, it did in a way. It felt like at least a preface of what the trial will be, but it did in some ways feel like a miniature trial. I mean, first of all, we did hear from the family members of George Zimmerman. As you said, they spoke by phone because they had fears for their safety. They say that they've been receiving some threats and some hate mail. So we heard from George Zimmerman's wife, we heard from his mother and his father, and they all said that they gave evidence of his good character, essentially saying that he was not a violent person, that basically he was a good person, and also saying that if he was to be bonded, that they would help the court ensure that he did show up for his next appearance and his trial.
Yeah. Well, George Zimmerman's mother said he had mentored a teenaged African-American boy. His father, Robert Zimmerman, said that after the shooting, he saw his son's face swollen. But we understand assistant prosecutors pressed the family on incidents where George Zimmerman had been accused of violence by a former girlfriend and a law enforcement officer. So it went on for 2.5 hours. Also, Zimmerman's defense lawyer said state investigators didn't have anything. What did state investigators say?
Yeah, they were put on one of the state investigators, Dale Gilbreth, was put on the stand. He said he wasn't actually prepared to give testimony today, so he seemed a little unprepared in some ways. He was pressed pretty hard about what was in that affidavit of arrest, which it mentioned some evidence from the person who Trayvon Martin was talking to on the phone moments before he was shot and killed. There was some evidence about that. And also about who started the confrontation. And in fact, that very word confrontation, Mark O'Mara, who's the lawyer representing George Zimmerman, really said, asked the prosecutor what evidence he had to even put that word in that confrontation, and essentially asked him if he knew who had started the fight. And later on down the track, in this cross-examination, the investigator, Dale Gilbreth, admitted that he didn't know who started that fight. So I guess a shade of things to come when the trial actually does get underway.
As we said, if George Zimmerman makes bail, he's expected to be in jail today. If he makes bail, he'll have GPS monitoring. He has to contact authorities. Can't have contact with Trayvon Martin's family. But the judge said that his lawyer and the state should get together and figure out whether he should be allowed to leave the state for his safety. What's your sense of if that's going to happen?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, it's pretty hard to read what judges will do before they actually make their ruling. But, of course, one thing to note, that the prosecutor, Bernie De La Rionda, had asked for bail to be set at $1 million. And clearly there's a bit of a discrepancy there between the bail that was actually set, $150,000. The family has to come up with about 10% of that, $15,000 as a deposit to bail them out of jail. They did talk, of course, about the idea of GPS monitoring to make sure that he's not a flight risk. He has surrendered his passport. That was the very first thing that Mark O'Mara did. He brought up the passport and said, well, here it is. I'm giving it up. It expires actually later this year, but here it is so that you know that George Zimmerman isn't a flight risk. And, of course, he spoke at length about how throughout this process, some 50 days since the killing, George Zimmerman has been monitored by authorities, has been in contact with them, and when he was charged, he turned himself in.
Well, on the other hand, we also know that Trayvon Martin's parents walked away after this hearing, seeming upset, the low bail, and that he will be released soon. Matthew Petty of NPR member station WMFE in Sanford, Florida. Thanks so much for this really quite a day there in Sanford. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, today we're going to take a Friday break from the news with a look at the musicians behind the hits. Did you ever wonder who wrote and performed that piano part on Bridge Over Troubled Water? Or the piano solo at the end of Layla? Do you know which drummer is playing taped together orange juice bottles on the Beach Boys' God Only Knows?
God only knows what I'd be without you.
In fact, do you know the musicians who played almost every instrument on Beach Boys' recordings?
If you should ever leave me.
Or on the Ronettes' Be My Baby. The vocals are the names you know, but the music was recorded and in many cases improved upon by a group of studio musicians in Los Angeles called the Wrecking Crew. Some would go on to their own fame, Glenn Campbell and Leon Russell, but others you may not know, bassist Carol Kaye, pianist Larry Nechtal, or drummer Hal Blaine. Bruce Springsteen has been known to yell out Hal Blaine's name during a particularly good drum solo by Max Weinberg. Now, these musician stories are being told in the new book, The Wrecking Crew, The Inside Story of Rock and Roll's Best Kept Secret. Author Kent Hartman joins us from Portland, Oregon. Kent, welcome.
Oh, thank you very much.
And we're also joined by one of the leading members of The Wrecking Crew, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, drummer Hal Blaine in Palm Desert,
hey,
California.
That's me. That's me.
What an honor, Hal. You know, hearing this music, when you hear this music that you had such a part in, do the memories flood back?
You know, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't, because so much of that music was just a blur. I mean, we were going from studio to studio to studio, and we never knew what we were doing, but that was one of the reasons they hired us instead of the actual group, like the Birds or whoever, because it would take them forever to make a record. We could go in there within a three-hour period, and the record would be finished.
Well, let me just read a list, because, Kent, you have this terrific anthology in the back of the book. Here's just a few. The Beach Boys' Surfer Girl and Surfin' USA, Jan and Dean's Dead Man's Curve, Little Old Lady from Pasadena, Gary Lewis and the Playboys' This Diamond Ring, Mr. Tambourine Man, The Birds, Barry McGuire, Eve of Destruction, Sonny and Cher, I Got You, Babe, The Mamas and the Papas, Monday, Monday, The Righteous Brothers, Soul and Inspiration, Frank Sinatra, Strangers in the Night. Talk a little bit about some of these iconic pieces. We read when you were recording Bridge, for instance, Bridge Over Troubled Waters, you kept picturing a troubled man shuffling along a dirt road as part of a chain gang.
When Paul Simon sang the song for me, that was the picture that I got. And for some reason, when I thought about the chains, I knew that I had some chains in my automobile. And so I ran out and got those tire chains and did an overdub with the tire chains.
Slapping them against the concrete floor.
Exactly.
Yeah.
See how they shine.
Ken Hartman, we know that other music capitals had their great studio musicians. Nashville had the A-Team, Muscle Shoals in Alabama. But you write that the Wrecking Crew stands above everyone else. What did they do? I mean, I'm afraid, I think Hal might be too modest. How much did they add to the music that was the soundtrack for this country?
Everything. I mean, the reason the producers wanted to hire Hal over and over and over and everybody like him was that they played better and faster than anybody you could get, and they had a natural feel for that music. In my opinion, anyway, they were all mini arrangers, and so they would add things to their parts that others wouldn't do, whether it was on Be My Baby for the Ronettes and Phil Spector, or Houston by Dean Martin. Hal and the others like him showed up with a bag of tricks, and they knew just what to do to make a song a hit.
Hal Blaine, talk about the Dean Martin song, Houston. We understand you turned some ashtrays upside down to...
Well, what happened was that when we finished the recording, I went in to Jimmy Bowen, the producer, and I said, Jim, I'd like to do a little overdub on that. He said, sure, go ahead. There was a big glass ashtray, And I took one of my little triangle beaters, and I started playing it. We're going to Houston, ting, Houston, ting, Houston, ting. For some reason, I had the picture of a blacksmith with an anvil and the way they hit, you know, put the shoes on the horses, the horseshoes.
It's sad, the shape I'm in, going back to Houston, Houston, Houston.
Well, Kent Hartman, you know, there were so many of the things that Hal Blaine and others did to improve upon the music. And, you know, Hal, we're reading, told a young Karen Carpenter, you know, I think you're not singing in the right key. I think you should sing lower. And down the road, she does start singing lower. And, of course, that, you know, she becomes one of the most incredible voices.
Why do birds suddenly appear every time you are near? Just like me, they long to be close to you.
You talk about piano player Larry Nechtel lying on the floor for Brian Wilson to play his Hammond B3 organ pedals with his hands instead of his feet. It was this kind of, as you said, maybe tricks, but also musical knowledge, just the vast amount of musical knowledge that they brought. But not everybody was happy. I mean, some of the artists, Dean Martin, for instance, he understands he's going to have studio musicians. But some of the famous groups did not know this when they signed up. And even when they came to their recording sessions, they were surprised to find out they weren't going to play.
It was the drummer for the Byrds, Michael Clark. I was told by various people that he was like really the one guy that didn't take it too well, that Hal was replacing him. And so he had a little shouting match with Terry Melcher, the producer. But Terry won, and Mr. Tambourine Man became a number one hit, so the proof was in the drumming for sure.
Well, Jerry Cole also replaced a guy named David Crosby on the Byrds' Mr. Tambourine Man. I mean, there were other artists that knew this was going on, obviously, and didn't have a negative reaction to it. But Hal, did you have some sympathy when some of the artists were crushed to find out that they were not going to be the ones recording the songs?
My position was that I had to do a job. It's like, you know, a policeman has to write a ticket because a guy broke the law.
Everybody sing Mr. Tambourine Man. That's just one of the many hit songs that studio musicians like our guest drummer Hal Blaine played on in the 60s and 70s. Here's some more. Mason Williams, Classical Gas, The Grassroots, Midnight Confessions. Oh, that's going back. Art Garfunkel's All I Know. Hal sent us a montage that runs about 5 minutes at 10 seconds per song of the songs that he played on. I mean, that's how many there are. And we'll post it at hereandnow.org, where there's also some photographs. Meanwhile, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'd like to ask Hal about the most famous member of the Wrecking Crew, Glenn Campbell, in 1 minute, Here and Now. Welcome back to our conversation about the Wrecking Crew, studio musicians in Los Angeles who played the instruments when hit songs in the 60s and 70s like California Dreamin' by the Mamas and the Papas were recorded. We're talking with Wrecking Crew drummer Hal Blaine and Kent Hartman, whose new book is The Wrecking Crew, The Inside Story of Rock and Roll's Best Kept Secret. And Kent, it really was a secret. The late Bruce Gary, drummer for the group The Knack, once said he was disappointed to find that 10 of his favorite drummers were, in fact, Hal Blaine, because it was Hal on drums for the Beach Boys, the Monkees, Frank Sinatra, and so many others.
Hal was in such demand. I interviewed all the famous producers, Herb Alpert, I talked to Lou Adler, I talked to Bones Howe, and every one of them said that Hal was their number one call drummer. And if you, like I say in my book, if you didn't have Hal, you wanted to get Hal. And because of that, he wasn't just paid the regular union scale like many others. Hal would get double or triple scale, and that really added up because that was a strong union, Local 47. And so Hal was making some pretty good money there, and as he might or might not want to tell you, at one point he had a mansion and a Rolls Royce.
Love will keep us together.
What happened? It seemed to screech to a halt in about 1975. You did Captain and Tennille's Love Will Keep Us Together, or the Wrecking Crew musicians did. And then it seemed to fall off. What happened?
We had robots come in called computers. And once again, economics. You know, you could do an entire record with Pro Tools and all of the various electronic things that came along. I could go into a studio personally alone and do a hand clap and make an entire record with, just from that hand clap of overdubbing sounds. And they would all be in tune. I could whistle, even if I was out of tune. The Pro Tools would bring it into tune. And that's just the way it was. I mean, it's unfortunate, but that's the way it was. Time marches on. Your fame is 10 minutes long. That's it.
Yeah.
During the 60s and early 70s, the rock and roll recording in Los Angeles was very much a producer's medium, and the producers were in charge, and they selected the musicians that they wanted to have play. But by the mid-70s, with bands like the Eagles and the Doobie Brothers and Chicago coming along, you know, they pretty much insisted on playing their own instruments, and so I think that had a little impact, too.
Yeah. Well, and what producers they were. Hal, you got to work with Phil Spector on songs like The Crystals' He's a Rebel. Jimmy Webb on just about everything he was writing, Wichita Lineman and Time I Get to Phoenix, By the Time I Get to Phoenix.
MacArthur Park.
I don't think that I can take it, 'cause it took so long to bake it, and I'll never have the recipe again.
The greatest musicians in the world were in Hollywood at the time.
We'll talk about one of them, Glenn Campbell, who, again, started out as the sideman, knew he wanted to have a solo career. He hears the song By the Time I Get to Phoenix, knows he wants to record that, but still, you know, member of the Wrecking Crew. Even when he was recording his own music, he recorded it with him, with Jimmy Webb. Today he's on a goodbye tour.
Yeah, I know.
Has Alzheimer's. What are some of your memories of Glenn Campbell?
Glenn was just the sweetest, nicest guy in the world. Glenn and I were working in a nightclub with Leon at the old Palomino Club out in North Hollywood. And Glenn was the only guy that did not read music. Every one of us were graduates of music schools, conservatories, whatever. Glenn was the only guy that didn't read a note of music. But he played such incredible solos. And the way it worked, because people have asked, well, how did he, you know, be on records with Dean Martin? He became very close to Dean because they were golfing buddies. But in the beginning, Glenn was just a guy that was sitting there chomping at the bit, and then the conductor or whoever wrote whatever, the composer, they'd point. Now, Glenn would do these incredible off-the-wall solos. They were just unbelievable. He could hear a song once, and he could do whatever he wanted with it. And people loved him. He was just a great guy. So everybody's out there saying prayers for Glenn.
Well, Ken Hartman, can you think of a Glenn Campbell solo that you'd like us to hear as we go that isn't one, you know, from a Glenn Campbell hit that is from that... The young kid, the picture you have in your book, he looks about 10, you know, from early on. Can you think of one we should listen to?
The guitar work on Dance, Dance, Dance by the Beach Boys, he seems particularly proud of that. And so, you know, it's got a really fast-paced guitar in there, and that's Glenn's style, and he did that.
Yeah.
That was great.
Yeah. That's Rock and Roll Hall of Famer drummer Hal Blaine.
Right.
He's featured prominently in Kent Hartman's new book, The Wrecking Crew, The Inside Story of Rock and Roll's Best Kept Secret, and it's a story of the studio musicians that backed just about every hit in the 60s and 70s. Kent and Hal, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Robin, it's a pleasure.
After 6 hours of school, I had enough of the day. I hit the radio dial and turned it up all the way. I got a dance.
And remember, we had that conversation with Glenn Campbell recently about his career and his struggle with Alzheimer's. We'll have that link at hereandnow.org. And as we go into the break, why don't we note the passing of another great musician, Levon Helm, singer and drummer from the band.
Virgil Caine is a
Wilco's Jeff Tweedy posted this on Facebook. Levon was the glue, not just in the band, but in all of what people think of when they think of North American music. He unified blues and country, rural and city, even north and south. Luckily, he showed us all the way to keep it together and let it swing. Levon Helm was born near Turkey Scratch, Arkansas in 1940. He died yesterday in New York. He was 71. Latest news is next, here and now. That's the Jay-Z Kanye West song In Paris. We can't play much more because it features both the N and F words. But it's being used by François Hollande, the socialist candidate running for president of France, to reach out to minorities ahead of the first round of voting on Sunday. Polls show Hollande defeating President Nicolas Sarkozy, who claimed at a recent rally that he would be reelected. But we should add that rally was at the Place de la Concorde, where French kings have lost their heads. Christopher Dickey is Paris bureau chief for Newsweek. You can also read him in the Daily Beast. He's in Paris. Chris, Sarkozy came into office promising to make conservative decisions to bring austerity to improve the economy. Is this the beginning of the end for him?
Well, he looks like he's in terrible shape. I mean, every one of the polls shows that he will come in behind in the first round of elections, and then the final and decisive round will be between him and François Hollande on May 6th, and most polls have him behind by about 10 points, which is pretty decisive. Now, there could be surprises, but it looks like he's toast.
And what has happened here? He, at one point, was talking about the German model of austerity. He's not doing that anymore. Hollande, the socialist candidate, says he wants to tax the rich. At one point, he was talking about 75%. Is this a shift in the populace? What's happening?
Well, first of all, I think you have to remember that when Sarkozy came in 2007, everybody thought the global economy was growing like gangbusters. In fact, it was. And he actually managed the country pretty well up until the end of last year. But during this campaign, he's just been all over the map, where he had been a great ally of Germany in the economic battles, and now he's changing direction every which way from Sunday.
And Germany, of course, in an austerity program.
Absolutely, and they have the resources to do it, apparently. France is in a little bit more vulnerable position, and it's very much caught up in the debate that we hear in the United States, too. Do you continue to have austerity to the point where you have no growth, and then the austerity doesn't help you anymore? Or do you, in fact, do different things to create more incentives for growth? And basically what Hollande is saying is we need to focus on growth and not on austerity. And Sarkozy is saying, but we can't afford it. And that's where the debate's going. But what it really comes down to, Robin, is people just hate Sarkozy.
Okay.
It's really about personality.
Well, he's seen as prickly, arrogant. But tell us more about the socialist candidate, François Hollande. We began with the Jay-Z Kanye West song. It's actually a campaign video for Hollande. It has pictures showing him going to poor areas, talking to people of color. Tell us more about his message.
Well, his message is essentially that he's not Sarkozy. I mean, I don't want to make this a circular argument, but the problem is that Sarkozy looks like a gangster to a lot of people in France. Not that he's criminal, but he's this little tough guy with a chip on his shoulder who's erratic, intense, coarse. They want to see Monsieur le Président, and they see Joe Pesci instead when they look at Sarkozy.
Well, you know, it's funny. A couple things. First of all, we talked about the candidate Hollande appealing to minorities. We read that by law, public opinion polling can't be broken down by ethnic, racial, or religious backgrounds in France.
But it is broken down by neighborhood, and there are neighborhoods that are much more preponderantly minority neighborhoods than others, which is, in fact, exactly where the Hollande video is taking place, in precisely those neighborhoods, a lot of which were burning in 2005 when Sarkozy was the interior minister.
Yeah, the angry riots then. But, you know, the other thing that's interesting is that we're reading that it was thought that the far right and far left candidates, who are enormously popular, pulling in huge enthusiastic crowds, would pull the two front runners to the right or the left. The Wall Street Journal's very conservative editorial page today is bemoaning the fact that the top two candidates seem indistinguishable. They've really had it with Sarkozy.
Yeah, everybody's pretty much had it with Sarkozy. I mean, I almost feel sorry for him. I mean, what is Hollande's core message? He literally uses this word. He says, I am the normal candidate. It tells you that people think there's something really abnormal about Sarkozy. That tells you really what the central dynamic is in this election.
Quite something. Christopher Dickey, Paris bureau chief for Newsweek. You can also read him on the Daily Beast. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Twitter claims 175 million users, everyone from actor James Franco's grandma Mitzi to President Obama. And now me, you can follow me at Here Now, Robin, though I'm not sure it's going to be quite as exciting as William Shatner or Rainn Wilson, the actor from The Office, who recently tweeted, "If Snooki gives birth to the Antichrist, I'll be all I told you so." Wilson is one of the 140 top tweeters of 2012, according to Time magazine. Allie Townsend is social media editor for Time. She joins us from their studios. And by the way, she's on Twitter at Allie Townsend. And Allie, you helped compile this list based on what? Because we understand it's not on the number of followers.
No, it's not on the number of followers. I think that there are a lot of other indicators that tell us who's using social media well. And one of those things is engagement. We focused a lot on people who are not only putting things out into Twitter, but are also saying things back. They're having conversations.
So pick one.
I think Andy Borowitz is probably a great example. Yeah. He responds. He's hilarious. But he's also conversational, and that's important. People want to participate.
By the way, we read Andy Borowitz's tweets a lot on the air because he is such a social commentator. And you've broken the tweeters into different categories. You have humor, you have culture and underculture. Sesame Street, they send out great tweets purportedly from, you know, the Muppets, and art style, photography, tech and geek. Then you've got experts. Expert in what?
You know, we have professors from Princeton. We have professionals at NASA. We have international relations experts. So much information comes from a lot of different directions, and these are a group of people that we really think you can get just pure information and data from.
Well, for instance, you've got Neil deGrasse Tyson, obviously such a well-known authority on space, Bill Nye the Science Guy, the Library of Congress. But then John Hodgman. John Hodgman was the PC in the Mac ads.
He was PC, and he has a really wonderful way of opening conversations, and I think that's what made him perfect for our list.
He's about 700,000 followers, and the tweet that you pick is he's in an airport, and he says, "I'm so mad that I've not been able to get a picture of this sparrow in the Orlando airport. This is going to end up with me in jail." You know, not some heavy social commentary. I mean, some of the others under the expert category are tweeting about Syria or Iran or women's rights. He's what? A sparrow in an airport.
He is someone who we follow because he's entirely relatable. He seems like a really down-to-earth person who's able to have conversations well.
Let's pick some more out. In the sports section, you've got Tim Tebow. Here's one of his. "Praise the Lord. Couldn't be any prouder of my teammates for believing in each other till the very end." That was from December. And then there's Shaq. Shaquille O'Neal. You say it's hard to match the randomized brilliance of Shaq's tweets. Why?
Shaq is kind of unique because he does not have much of a filter. And I think people really love getting to know the person behind this sports superstar.
Here's his tweet about the Knicks' Jeremy Lin. "Lindarella story of the year. Jeremy Lin has lingle-handedly played Lensational, Lincredible. I'm Lin pressed. All he does is Lin, 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 and then GD, JIB, good job," I think.
I think that's probably it.
Sneaking in at the end there. Michelle Obama, Barack Obama are there. And this is a question that I have. How do you know it's them tweeting?
Their campaign staff does tweet for them. They sign off on personal tweets. When the president is tweeting, he will sign the end of the tweet with a B-O. And that's a really nice way to let people know this is the president tweeting, because we understand that he has a country to run. He's not going to tweet every day himself from his account.
Is it the same for Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich, who are also in your politics category?
Their staffs do run their Twitter feeds. And actually, I'm really impressed by Newt Gingrich's feed. He was also on our list last year, and when he has something to say, Twitter is one of the first places that he pushes that out.
And there are others, as we said, under experts and politics. You have people tweeting about foreign affairs and international events. We have people that we would know, Yoko Ono, Seth Meyers, Steve Carroll. Pick one, though, a non-celebrity, who's just sort of suddenly made it, you know, crafted a life for themselves and a certain celebrity because of their tweets.
I think that's probably Kelly Oxford. She's a mother of three who has a Twitter account. But she's been able to carve out such a wonderful dialogue day to day. She is hysterical. She is witty. She is smart. She is also an established writer, and she's worked on screenplays and TV shows. It's also great because I think we portray mothers in a very demure light sometimes, and she's kind of breaking that. You know, she's the anti-mommy blogger, and it's refreshing to see that.
The sound you just heard was thousands of moms across the country saying, "Where is that Twitter account? I want to hear it." What else do tweets get someone? I mean, if you have a blog, you might sell advertising space on it eventually if you get enough followers. What happens for tweets?
Well, I mean, if you're Steve Martin, you get a book deal. He published an entire book of his tweets. Tim Pool, who is a young independent journalist, he's someone who used his Twitter account and a live stream to take us inside the Occupy Wall Street movement. He was in the center of it, and we started looking to him to provide us with firsthand accounts.
Have you heard from anybody who, you know, we know people who are getting off of Facebook, for instance. They've just had it. They can't keep up with it. Has that started to happen yet for Twitter, people shutting it down because it's too much?
I don't know about people shutting it down. I think that we are seeing there's a lot of noise. And this is one of the reasons why we like to produce these lists, is because we can help people cut through that noise and focus in on the people who are really, really using Twitter in informative ways. I think people start to get into trouble when they wind up following 1,200 accounts and all of a sudden they find reading their Twitter stream unmanageable day to day.
Allie Townsend, social media editor for Time Magazine, on their top 140 Twitter feeds of 2012. Allie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And a quick programming note, Mother's Day is coming, and we're looking for recipes from Mom. We'll be talking with Here Now resident chef Kathy Gunst about recipes handed down from moms, grandmoms. For Here Now, senior producer Kathleen McKenna, it was her late mom's Irish soda bread. Producer Emiko Tamagawa treasures her late mom's German apple cake recipe. For me, it's my late mom's tuna noodle casserole with potato chips on top. Share your family's recipes at herenow.org. Just click on Recipes from Mom on the right-hand column. And if you happen to have handwritten recipes, you know, maybe scrawled on index cards, snap a picture, send them as well at hereandnow.org. Today, the Red Sox are celebrating the 100th birthday of Fenway Park, what John Updike called a lyric little bandbox of a ballpark, like an old-fashioned peeping-type Easter egg, you know, the ones with some jewel within the shell. Today, there will be a game between the Sox and the Yankees. Yesterday, the park was open to the public, free. They swarmed the field and perused tables of memorabilia. Here, photos and keepsakes from the late Ted Williams.
Him kissing the bat, that to me is just like true appreciation of the game and true appreciation for what he stood for and all the hard work that he did.
Dude, look at, one of Ted Williams' fishing poles.
No way. He fished?
Which got me thinking about my time with Ted Williams.
It was 1941. What people were talking about more than anything else that summer was a tall, skinny kid from San Diego who was tearing the cover off the ball for the Boston Red Sox. The sports writers called him the Splendid Splitter, Ted Williams.
Okay, it wasn't way back then, and it was just a few conversations, but still.
Try and bend your knees just a little bit. Try and stay down that low pitch.
There was that time at spring training in the mid-1970s. Ted had been retired since 1960. I was barely in my 20s. He barely tolerated me hanging on the batting cage with him as he offered hitting tips to players.
You know, something was said to me as a young player that meant an awful lot to me, and I always leaned back on this. It was a great thing. A great hitter, Lefty O'Doul. And I asked him, like I always asked all the great hitters as a young fella coming up, what do I have to do to become a great hitter? And he said, kid, don't change anything.
What'd you hit last year, Park?
250.
My first one I ever heard say it, that hitting a baseball was the hardest single thing to do in sports. I used to lay in bed thinking, well, why am I doing it this way? Why am I successful this way? And then I'd get in a rut, and more times than not, I could pretty near, just thinking about it, say, boom, I know why I'm not hitting.
Well, that's probably the most important advice, to tell somebody to go off and think about it.
I had a big advantage over the one you're just talking about, because I didn't just go over in the corner and think about it. I thought about it all the time. All the time. I'd watch the movie and be thinking about it. I had a bad day. It bothered me during the movie and after the movie and when I went to bed. And the next morning, why, I was all stirred up, ready to go again. Who was going to pitch and what was going on? And I'm sure that a lot of hitters go to the ballpark now and they don't know who the hell's pitching. And I can guarantee you the first thing I looked is probable pitchers. And I knew who, and probably before we even went into town. There's not a player I ever saw, as long as I played, that I didn't think should have been is better than he was. Should have been better than he was.
Including yourself?
Yes, ma'am.
What about the fact that it's Ted Williams telling them what to do? How do you think that affects them?
Well, I'd like to think that they thought I knew what I was talking about.
Ladies and gentlemen, he wore the Red Sox uniform for 22 years. He wore the uniform of the United States Marines for 4.5 more. He owned left field at this very ballpark. He was the last man to hit 400 in a season, and he did it 58 years ago. He hit 521 home runs, including one on his last at-bat. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the greatest hitter that ever lived, number 9, Hall of Famer, baseball legend, Ted Williams.
Okay, Robin, here's the Splendid Splinter.
Oh, man.
Hello, Robin.
Hey, Ted.
Fast forward to 1999. Ted was in town to throw out the first pitch at the All-Star Game. I was hosting another radio program with two equally starstruck sidekicks, George Knight and Matt Phipps, when Ted called in. I reminded him of that time back at spring training when we'd also engaged in a little of his second passion, fishing.
Ted, I don't know if you remember a movie when John Wayne was in a film called True Grit and he had to take a girl out on a trail.
Yeah.
That was kind of like our day fishing.
This was an older Ted Williams, his health failing, his legendary curmudgeonliness softening.
How are you feeling?
Well, you know, I'm getting old. Geez, I'm getting old. I have better days and good days. And God, the saddest thing in my life right now is I'm losing a lot of friends.
Yes.
And they're sick, or they got new teeth, or they got a new knee, or something. That's the saddest part about getting old. Geez. Mm.
But in your case, you've got terrific memories. Let's talk about the other end of the spectrum. We've got a new Red Sox team this year. How do you feel they're doing?
Well, their pitching seems to be surprisingly pretty good.
Some say the best ever.
Yeah, might be.
And how about Nomar Garcia Parra?
Oh, boy, Nomar. Hell, he's... Anytime you go to the ballpark and just keep your eyes glued on him and you're seeing one of the great players, potential great players. And players that I haven't always heard so much about, and then I see him and I say, boy, this is a pretty good little player.
Ted,
yes, sir.
We're talking to Ted Williams, which frankly we can't believe. And, you know, I'm the one who says Fenway Park will come down over my dead body. You frankly don't care, do you?
Well, you have an exalted feeling about Fenway Park, and you think I would too, and I do in certain ways. But I really, in my heart, one of the great baseball towns of all time, with the oldest park in the league, I think that somebody ought to get up in arms and say, boom, we do need a new park.
Ted Williams will throw out tonight's ceremonial first pitch. He will throw it to Carlton Fisk. Kyle Yastrzemski on hand as well. A celebration here tonight.
Oh, all right.
Well, I'll never forget my first time in there. I'll never forget the first time I looked at it. And I can never forget the old ball players that I played with, and there were some good ones. And the nicest part about getting old on this side of the ledger is that they're still friends. I'm so happy when I feel they're getting along good.
Name some that you're still...
Well, I think Mel Parnell's getting along good. Dominic DiMaggio's getting along pretty good. Dorr and Pesky are getting along pretty good. He looks better than anybody.
Hey, Ted. Ted Williams, I got to ask you, where did you get the reputation for being such a tough old guy when here you're a softie?
Well, I'm a softie.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Boy, that's great. Now, the thing of it is that I probably wasn't too smart, a super sensitive type, that if I heard a boo, I could hear it for 4 miles. I probably didn't handle that too well, but I suppose if it happened again, it'd be just like that again. I don't know. I couldn't have done it any different.
I want to have said, if you ever get really lonely, you know, I could come down and we could go fishing again and I could drive you crazy.
Well, I would love to. I would be great. I can't go now. That's the greatest sorrow of my life right now, other than seeing some of my friends getting old. But the fact that I can't fish anymore or wade anymore or tie flies anymore or rig anymore, that hurts me.
Yeah. Well, you know that you have a ton of friends that you don't even know.
Yeah, I
up
know.
Here in
I
Boston.
Got a million friends. I fooled a lot of people.
Not at all.
Yeah, all right. Nice to talk to you, dear.
Ted Williams, thank you so much.
All right, dear. Hold on.
This is it. Ted Williams going to the bat rack for the final time.
Everybody quiet now here at Fenway Park after they gave him a standing ovation of 2 minutes, knowing that this is probably his last time at bat. One out, nobody on, last of the eighth inning. Jack Fisher into his windup. Here's the pitch. Williams swings, and there's a long drive to deep right. That ball is gone, and it is gone. A home run for Ted Williams in his last...
Ted Williams died in 2002. Fenway, the place he loved but wanted to blow up and build all over again, turns 100 today. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend and join us again here and now.